The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. The next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the December 2022 issue of the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article is entitled, Engage Your Heart and Brain, Even When You're Sitting. Sitting too much is bad for health. Here's how to soften the blow a little. The dangers of too much sitting are increasingly clear. Research regularly links a sedentary lifestyle, especially long, uninterrupted bouts of sitting, to higher risks of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer, brain shrinkage, muscle loss, poor posture, back pain, and premature death. That's bad news whether you sit a lot because of work, travel, fatigue, illness, or you just like to lounge. While it's best to stay active throughout your day, get up and move every 30 minutes if possible. There are ways to make your sit time a little healthier. Challenge your brain. One way to boost the health of your sit time is by keeping your brain active. In an active brain, neurons fire vigorously and form new connections. Greater numbers of connections translate to greater brain reserve or backup cells if the plaque and tangles of Alzheimer's disease start to form, says Dr. Andrew Budson, Chief of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the VA Boston Healthcare System. Passive activities like watching TV have the opposite effect on the brain. Neurons fire only weakly, and new connections aren't being made. Increasing evidence suggests that with the brain, it's use it or lose it. For example, a large study published online August 22, 2022, by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, found that people who spend a lot of time sitting and watching TV seem to have higher risks for dementia than people who spend a lot of time sitting and using a computer, regardless of their physical activity levels. This doesn't mean that watching TV is necessarily unhealthy. It probably means there isn't much on TV that truly engages our mind. To keep your brain active while you're sitting, consider turning off the TV and doing some of the following activities. Expand your horizons. Read a book on a new subject, listen to a new type of music, or learn a new language. There are many free smartphone apps to get you started. Play a game. Play cards or a board game with friends, or play word games on an app or with pen and paper. Don't play the same game too long. Keep challenging your brain, Dr. Budson says. Get something on paper. Write a poem for a friend. Type a story for your grandkids. Draw a picture and color it in. Paint with watercolors. It doesn't have to be an award winner. Just let your creativity flow. Another idea is to take up a new hobby. Try your hand at a hobby that's suited to sitting. This would include knitting, crocheting, needlepoint, cross-stitch, model building, or leather working. There are many starter kits available online. Visit with friends. Face-to-face interactions, even when sitting, engage the brain and promote new brain cell connections. Make some music. Play an instrument if you have one. Learn a new song or come up with your own, even a short one. Be sure to vary the activities you do while you're parked on a chair or couch. Varied challenges, especially new ones, make the brain work harder, which keeps it healthier. Another way to boost the health of your sit time is by exercising while sitting. Yes, it really is possible to do an effective aerobic workout, the kind that gets your heart and lungs working from a seated position. Doing a series of moves with your arms and legs like arm circles, air punches, leg lifts, and marching or stepping will increase your heart rate and get your blood flowing. You need to sustain those activities for 10, 20, or even 30 minutes, says Janice McGrail, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. What makes a good aerobic workout when you're seated? Anything that motivates you to move, McGrail says. It could be a calisthenics routine, or it could be a seated boxing workout. There are seated dance routines choreographed to many kinds of music, including disco, country, and even polka. From a seated position, you can do strengthening exercises like bicep curls, resistance bands like rowing movements, or using your body weight like leg lifts that you hold for 5 seconds. These exercises make your muscles stronger and help you control blood sugar and metabolism. While seated, you can also do stretching exercises on most of the major muscle groups to keep them long, supple, and less prone to injury. And all exercise, whether it's aerobic activity, strengthening, or stretching, helps the body maintain good health. It wards off chronic disease like heart disease, high blood pressure, and diabetes. It keeps your muscles and bones strong, improves balance, and helps control mood and weight. It promotes better sleep and thereby protects your independence. It also protects your brain. Exercise promotes the growth of new brain cells and boosts memory and blood flow to the brain, Dr. Budson says. To find free seated workout videos, look at YouTube. Search for the kind of exercise that interests you and see if there's a seated version. It's best to follow a workout from a reliable source like a university. Silver Sneakers, which is a health fitness program, a certified personal trainer, or a physical therapist. To do a seated workout of any kind, take the same careful approach as you would to any workout. Use a stable chair. Wear socks and sneakers to protect your feet. Start with a warm-up of slow movements for a few minutes before you work out, and then do a cool-down of slow movements after you work out. Remember, the best workout is the one you'll do regularly. Overall, you want to aim for 150 minutes of aerobic exercise each week, as well as daily strengthening and stretching at least 2 times per week. Now we're going to turn to a section in the Harvard Health Letter that's called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff, MD, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. What's the future of remote patient monitoring? Dr. Komaroff is asked, I use a home blood pressure machine, and my doctor says it helps her to take better care of me. Are there other home machines measuring other aspects of my health that also could help her? There's a growing number of devices that monitor your body throughout the day, and many more are coming in the future. Nearly 50 million people in the United States currently use remote patient monitoring. Home blood pressure machines are among the first. Most of them require that you put a cuff around your arm, then tap a button. The cuff starts to tighten, and after 30 seconds, the cuff relaxes, and the machine shows your blood pressure on a little screen. That's neat, but the machine only measures your blood pressure when you remember to do so. And it doesn't send the results automatically to your doctor. It's not with you all the time, like when someone says or does something that would raise anyone's blood pressure. The miniaturization of electronics is leading to the development of next-generation devices. For example, there was a 2022 report in the journal Nature Nanotechnology describing an experimental device, a thin strip of material that you paste onto your skin just above your wrist. Like a sticky note, it stays securely on your skin, but you can easily remove it. Inside the strip are tiny sensors that painlessly and automatically measure the blood pressure in the artery that delivers blood to your hand. You go about your day normally, not even thinking about it. You can even exercise. The tiny sensors above your wrist just keep checking your blood pressure. Then, using your smartphone or smartwatch, and with your permission, the strip can automatically send the readings over the internet to your doctor's office. The office can spot worrisome trends you may be unaware of. For the present, people today are using various devices, typically smartwatches, to measure their heart rate, the regularity of their heart rhythm, the quality of their sleep, their body temperature, and the levels of oxygen and sugar in their blood. People with diabetes no longer need to stick their fingers to determine if their blood sugar is under control. They can stick their smartphone next to a little device pasted to their skin. As for the future, scientists are working on devices that measure other blood chemicals besides oxygen and sugar, and that constantly monitor the function of organs inside of us. Remote patient monitoring is still in its infancy, but I think it will be increasingly important in our future, says Dr. Komaroff. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter is entitled, Are Your Medications Keeping You Up at Night? Many common drugs can make it hard to fall or stay asleep. It's 4 a.m. and you can't sleep. As you lie awake wondering why, consider whether any of your medications could be causing the trouble. Medications can interfere with sleep in a number of ways. Some delay sleep onset, which is how long it takes you to fall asleep. Some cause frequent nighttime awakenings or trigger early morning awakening. And some medications impair sleep quality or how rested you feel in the morning, says Jennifer Korapi, a psychiatric clinical pharmacist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Medications that affect sleep can be prescription drugs or over-the-counter remedies. Here are some common culprits. And the first one is antidepressants. Antidepressants are typically prescribed to treat depression or anxiety, and they have various side effects, even within the same drug class. For example, among selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are called SSRIs, fluoxetine or Prozac can be stimulating and make it hard to fall or stay asleep. But another SSRI, paroxetine, which is also called Paxil, can be more sedating and make you sleepy. Another important class of medications is called beta blockers. Beta blockers like metoprolol and atenolol, and their names are Lopressor and Tenormin, are used primarily to treat high blood pressure or at a regular heartbeat. One side effect is that the medications can decrease the body's natural level of melatonin, a hormone that helps regulate your sleep-wake cycle. If beta blockers suppress melatonin, you might have trouble falling or staying asleep. Another category is decongestants. Decongestants like phenylephrine or pseudoephedrine help to shrink swollen membranes and nasal passages, allowing more air to pass through. Both drugs can be stimulating. They can raise your blood pressure and heart rate and may cause insomnia in some people, Korapi says. We don't recommend them for people with heart problems, a history of stroke, or high blood pressure. Another important class is the diuretics. Diuretics like furosemide or Lasix, torsemide or Demodex, and hydrochlorothiazide reduce the amount of sodium and water in the body. They're prescribed to treat high blood pressure, kidney disorders, liver disease, and fluid retention. Diuretics don't affect sleep directly, but they can interrupt sleep if they make you go to the bathroom during the night, Crappy says. Smoking cessation drugs. Over-the-counter nicotine replacement medications like nicotine patches, gum, or lozenges help people to stop smoking. Nicotine can cause someone to have unusual dreams or nightmares and wake them up. Prescription medications that curb smoking can also interfere with sleep. One drug, which is called varenicline or Chantix, affects the same brain areas as nicotine replacement products and can cause nightmares. Another drug, bupropion or Wellbutrin, is an antidepressant that may be stimulating and make it hard to fall asleep. Then there are steroids. Oral steroids like prednisone are used to reduce inflammation inside the body. Prednisone stimulates the production of the stress hormone cortisol and mimics what stress does to the body. And one thing stress does is to disrupt the sleep cycle. Steroids are usually taken short-term, but certain chronic diseases might require long-term therapy. So what can you do? There's a number of things you can do if you think your sleep problem could be related to your medications. For starters, write down the date, dose, and time of every drug you take, as well as any symptoms you experience, to find patterns linking symptoms to medications. You can also try the following strategies, if your doctor and pharmacist say it's okay. One is to take the medication during the day. This applies to drugs that make it hard to fall or stay asleep, cause nightmares, or make you have to get up and go to the bathroom. For example, don't take diuretics within 6 hours of bedtime, Karapi says. Think about taking melatonin as a supplement before bed. Melatonin is a hormone that regulates the sleep-wake cycle. It may help for the short term until your body gets used to the medication that's causing the sleep difficulty, Karapi says. Take a lower dose. Ask your doctor if lowering your medication dose will help you to get better sleep. Also, you should always practice good sleep hygiene. Go to bed and wake up in the same time every day. Avoid caffeine after lunch. Don't drink alcohol or eat close to bedtime. Turn off electronic screens an hour before bed and sleep in a cool, dark, comfortable spot. Or maybe the best solution is to switch to a new medication. If you've tried everything and sleep problems are becoming distressing, ask your doctor if you can switch to a medication that won't affect your sleep, Karapi says. There's often a good alternative. Now here's an interesting article in the Harvard Health Letter that's entitled, Should You Hire a Medical Wingman? These are the pros to turn to when navigating the healthcare system becomes a challenge. Coping with a medical condition involves more than taking care of yourself at home. You need to be able to schedule and get to medical appointments, work with your doctor, pick up medications, talk to your insurance company, pay medical bills, and more. And that's hard if you don't feel well, you're stressed, or you're on your own. But there are a number of professionals that can help. Before you pick up the phone, learn which experts will fit your needs and how much they're going to charge. Need someone to get you to the doctor, bring you by a pharmacy afterward, and take you home? You may need a home care aide, which is also called a home companion. That's a registered professional who can help you company, and help with errands, meal prep, and lighthouse work. If you need someone who can do all that plus help you to shower, dress, or use the bathroom, you'll need a personal care attendant, a PCA, or a licensed certified nursing assistant, a CNA. They have formal training and are legally allowed to provide hands-on physical care. Do you need someone to be with you and advocate for you in a medical setting? Call your insurance company. Make sure your medical bills are paid. Research treatment options and services. Hire and manage home care and more. Two types of professionals can help. An aging life care professional, which was formerly called a geriatric care manager, and a patient or health care advocate. These experts belong to professional organizations with codes of ethics that require certain skills, education, and experience levels. Both provide assessments, problem solving, advocacy, and education. But there are slight differences. The first group is the aging life care professional. These work only with older adults and are well known for being developers and coordinators of care plans. We're the quarterback of an older adult's care. We'll connect you to resources, manage them, go to doctor's appointments and hospitals, and hold your hand throughout the process, says Deborah Feldman, president of the board of directors of the Aging Life Care Association. Then there are patient or healthcare advocates. These work with people of all ages. While they too can oversee the big picture, many choose to specialize in a particular field. Some patient advocates work only with specific populations, like people with cancer, neurologic disease, or mental health issues. These advocates can find specialists, research treatment options, make appointments, and sit at the bedside. Others focus on insurance or billing and dealing with appeals, says Dr. Heidi Coomer, president of the Patient Advocate Certification Board. Doctors look at these hired support professionals as additional members of your health team. They're a huge help to clinicians. Patients don't always clearly describe their symptoms and circumstances. Clinicians often don't get a complete picture of whether someone is taking medication, has enough to eat, has vaccines, or is falling frequently. Hired experts can usually answer those questions and let us know if the patient needs more help. The only drawback is cost, says Dr. Suzanne Salomon, Associate Chief of Gerontology at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Make sure the people who are helping you are qualified or certified in their field and are members of professional organizations. Ask how much they charge, and don't wait too long to reach out to someone for help. You should call before a crisis. If you already have a challenging health condition, it may make sense to get a consultation. Of course, a very important factor is how much does it cost? There's a wide range of fees for support services to navigate healthcare, and they depend on where you live and how much the hired professional does for you. The national average for a home care aide or a certified nursing assistant is $27 to $28 an hour. Fees for aging life care professionals and patient advocates range from $75 to $300 per hour. Medicare doesn't cover these costs. Some long-term care insurance plans and veterans benefits may pay part of the expense for CNAs. If you need to set up only basic care plan and you have family members to help you manage it, a social worker from your local area agency on aging or senior center may be able to make recommendations for free. Now I'm going to start a article called The Kidney Health Quick Start Guide. Your kidneys deserve as much care and protection as your heart or brain. Here's why and what you can do. We all want to protect our heart and our brain, but how often do you think about protecting your kidneys? The health of these two bean-shaped organs is easy to take for granted, especially since there aren't noticeable signs of trouble until chronic kidney disease has already developed. And with 37 million people in the United States struggling with the condition, and millions more at risk, it's important to pay attention to your kidneys now. What's the role of the kidneys? The kidneys, located on either side of the spine, just below your rib cage, perform many important functions. They route blood through a complex filtering system that removes toxins, holds on to fluid, salt, or other minerals the body needs, and sends the waste urine to the bladder to be flushed out of the body. These remarkable organs can also help regulate your blood pressure, convert vitamin D to its active form, and release hormones needed for blood pressure control and red blood cell treatment. Chronic kidney disease. Unhealthy lifestyle, chronic disease, and genetic conditions can damage the kidneys and reduce their ability to do their jobs. When your kidney doesn't function effectively to flush out toxins, the toxins build up in the blood. That can hurt the heart and brain and cause problems with blood pressure, blood, bones, and nerves, says Dr. Joseph Bonventra. I'll continue with this article next time. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's NCREADING. SERVICE.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.